The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Thank you, as always, for all of your comments and emails. Email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. We'll get to all of your comments from last week later on in the episode. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be speaking to Kevin Peter Hand, who's written a book about searching for alien life. He's a NASA researcher who's working on a couple of really interesting missions, and he also has an amazing story to tell about nearly dying and being saved by James Cameron, so you won't want to miss that. First though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining us as always on Skype is Dr. Laura Dungan and from UCD Dr. Susan Kelleher. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Is about how a star is born, and another 2 points if you manage to get the Lady Gaga reference to this story, which is Irish research, Susan.
Yeah, it's really wonderful news this week. So this research was published in the journal Nature, and it's led by Irish scientists, and they have proven a 30-year-old theory about how stars are born. So the work has been carried out by a large international team led by Rebecca Garcia Lopez, and she is in UCD, and she also has a position in the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. The funding came from this partially from SFI and the IRC, and they used 4 telescopes around the world to look at events unfolding on a star a million light years away. So to remind everybody, stars are formed by a massive cloud of gas and dust collapsing. The center of this collapse then gets hotter and denser and begins to draw in stuff from around it. So I suppose a good way of thinking about it is like a candy floss machine. You can imagine as the ball of candy floss is getting bigger and bigger, it's drawing stuff in from around it. The candy floss is adding to the ball and it's getting more dense. Now, with planets and stars, there's a lot of physics, right? They always get in the way, called the conservation of angular momentum. This means that drawing stuff down onto the surface to add to the mass of something is actually really tricky, as this matter, the matter, like the stuff that's coming down, would much rather orbit. It's far more inclined to orbit a body like that, such as our moon that orbits us, rather than drop down onto the surface. So there was a theory that how it was getting down onto the surface was through sort of a magnetic funnel. So this was thought of a number of years ago, but we could never figure out how it happened. So there was this idea that like there was a magnetic road that would bring stuff down from outside of the star into the center of the forming star to be able to create the mass and the matter, like adding in the mass and the matter into that material.
Right.
To form the star. Yeah, so this is what was the idea. Like, how is it jumping? Usually things would orbit, like how is it getting down onto the surface? And this work, they were able to detect this magnetic tunnel or magnetic road for the first time. So they were the first people to be able to see this matter jumping down onto the surface in a sort of a imagine following like this, again, the candy floss where it's moving down onto the surface. So it's really quite incredible for the first time ever to understand how a star is born and where the matter comes from and how it actually gets down there. So it's a remarkable piece of work, I have to say.
I really like the metaphor that you use, both the candy floss and the magnetic road. It really gives me a clear idea of what we're talking about here. I have a very pressing question, though. Do they still make candy floss? I haven't seen it in years.
While researching this, I went to double check. Is that what candy floss is? Because I remember from my childhood really vividly. I was like, is that still what happens when they make candy floss? So, I mean, look, I think if you want to, you can probably get yourself a nice, you know.
There's someone doing it somewhere.
Totally,
someone's still knocking out the candy floss. That's really cool. And it's great that it's Irish research. And congratulations to the Trinity researchers involved in that paper, because obviously Nature is a really big deal. Laura, our second story is about COVID, and it's more bad news. Animals could get COVID too.
Yeah, so I suppose a lot of people will have heard that a lot of research has shown that the virus that causes COVID-19, which is called SARS-CoV-2, probably came from bats. Its ancestor probably came from bats, and it probably came via another animal. We're not exactly sure which one that is.
Oh, yeah. So do you know what? I'm saying animals can get COVID too. Animals is where it came from, dummy.
Yeah.
But more animals than just bats is what I mean.
No, and that's exactly it. No, and most people wouldn't think this because we do know it's you know, almost certainly, like I said, came from bats. So we know it's a zoonotic virus, which is a virus that can infect animals. So new research that's come from the University of California, Davis, has shown that actually there's a reasonable chance that SARS-CoV-2 could infect a lot of animals. The worrying thing is that some of these animals are very endangered as well. So what they did was they took 410 different species of animals, and out of those, 252 were mammals. And they looked at their ACE2 protein. Now, ACE2 is the receptor in humans that the SARS-CoV-2 virus uses to enter our cells. So what they did was they looked and tried to match it, the 25 base pairs of amino acids, to animals in these 410 different animals. And they found that they were able to grade them into being high risk, medium risk, and low risk. So nothing bar mammals was in the medium to high risk. So it was only mammals that they would consider to be in these categories. And the high risk ones were what they call sort of old world monkeys. They're called catarrhine primates, but we would call them commonly old world monkeys. And this is quite distressing because obviously, like we said, it did come from animals. But if this were to jump into animals, and these include things like the Sumatran orangutan, the Western lowland gorilla, the northern white-cheeked gibbon, and these are endangered species, it could be catastrophic for their entire populations potentially. That is just really worrying. There's other mammals that were at a reasonable risk as well, for instance grey whales and bottlenose dolphins as well, and they find that certain animals.
How
like
is a bottlenose dolphin going to get COVID too?
Well, now let's be very clear on this research that this is not, they have not in any way infected these animals. All they've done is compared their ACE2 to our ACE2 and shown that it is similar enough that there is a sort of theoretical risk. So okay, a lot more research would need to.
Two questions. One is, will dogs and cats get it? Because obviously they are, the danger is not just, as you talked about, that this could decimate populations of animals, but also that even if we eradicate it in humans, it might find a reservoir in our family pet and we may never be rid of this bloody thing. So what about cats and dogs? What about really pervasive animals that exist in homes around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely the risk, and a reservoir is scary. I mean, we know that animals such as cats, minks, dogs, hamsters, lions, tigers have been infected with coronavirus. So yes, is the answer. They can get it. Whether or not they can get sick from it, whether or not they can give it back to humans is the question. So, and that is not answered yet. We don't know whether or not they can give it back to humans. But yes, they can get it because they have. And B, this research also shows that cats, cattle and sheep are medium risk, but dogs, horses and pigs were actually found to be low risk. Again, this is that their ACE2 is more dissimilar from our ACE2 than other animals such as these old world monkeys. But, you know, it's definitely a potential risk. We know they've caught it before. So, you know, it's there. That risk is there.
It just goes to show you can't make any assumptions. I would have thought that if we can give it to dogs, of course, we can get it back from dogs. But you're saying that's not necessarily the case.
No, it's actually not necessarily the case. I mean, the thing is that just because a dog can potentially become infected with the virus, it doesn't mean that the virus can very actively enter the cells of the dog if their ACE2 is significantly different. Maybe the virus could, you know, get into the dog, but really not take hold, really not cause the animal to be sick. And therefore, it would not then be able to reinfect other animals or humans. So just because you can catch a virus doesn't necessarily mean you can transmit it.
Right. What do we do now with this knowledge? I presume they're not going to be doing trials on animals, but are we going to start testing animals?
So, I mean, I suppose that's the thing. What we do is we just understand that this is a possibility and be cautious. So places like zoos, for instance, where they do have these kind of animals, will need to be very careful to protect their endangered animals and keep humans as physically far away as they possibly can. You know, so it's about making sure that we can protect animals if these animals are out in the wild. make sure humans aren't approaching them like they would have done, you know, people used to be able to go for tours with the gorillas in the wild. I just don't think that's safe or that's responsible at the moment. And so, you know, it's about, I think, protecting these animals as best we can, certainly not infecting them to see how badly they could get sick, but definitely they need to be protected, I think, certainly.
Susan, our third story has to do with caffeine and pregnant women.
Yeah, so this really caught my attention this week, and mainly due to...
By the way, where are you? Are you in a church or what's going on?
I apologise. I am in an absolutely beautiful holiday home with vaulted high ceilings. So that is the reason I sound particularly angelic today. Yes, thank you. The story is really, as I said, really caught my attention because... I suppose the headlines really made me sit up and say, what, you know, I had two babies, you know, should I be more aware of this? So the story is, it's a review article today that was published this week that looked at 42 previous reports and tried to draw a general conclusion on the effects of caffeine intake while pregnant on the rate of miscarriages, stillbirths, low birth weights, childhood obesity and childhood leukemia. So it was a big attempt by this author to do this. The conclusion that this author drew was that the current guidelines around caffeine consumption while pregnant need radical revisions. So that's quite a big statement. And he's also pointed to the fact that he thinks that all caffeine while pregnant should be avoided for increased risk of these things. And of course, anyone hearing that would be, first of all, surprised and also maybe quite terrified or worried if you were pregnant. So it is a very big statement. It has really been met with controversy already around this, I have to say. But I think there are really a number of really important things to point out here. So the first off, any previously reported risk, either mentioned in this review or otherwise, is really quite low. Of the article studied here, about a third of them stated that there was no risk at all. And two thirds of them stated there was a risk, but that it was low if you abide by the current guidelines. So I think that's really important just to get out in the first instance. The second thing is that the studies that this author looked at, his name is Professor Jack James, and he was based in Reykjavik University. So he looked at these studies, and they were what are called observational studies. So they're very hard to separate other factors like smoking, which we do know has effect on these on a lot of these risk categories. And a lot of people who smoke maybe drink coffee as well at the same time. So the problem with these types of studies is that you can't really conclude anything around one specific risk factor. So that's something that was sort of overlooked in this in his kind of trying to classify or trying to generally categorize this. And the third thing is that his review is it's not what we call a systematic review in science. So a systematic review is where a number of people get together, everyone looks at lots of data, they decide on which papers are important and which papers are good quality and which should be discussed and included and how do we all do that. So this is just one person writing this on their own, and they haven't really discussed, you know, how they've kind of gone about selecting their papers or how they drew their conclusions. So it's obviously a really big question that people want an answer to, but this certainly doesn't necessarily give the answer as far as I can see. But I think it is, I suppose, one thing that I think is really the final note I would say, just on my take on it, is that, you know, it doesn't supersede any of the current guidelines, which is this 200 mgs a day. So this is universally accepted as safe. And this is, you know, that's what I was thinking of and trying to come up with my 200 mgs a day that I desperately needed while absolutely exhausted.
Which is how many cups of coffee, Susan?
This is the question, Jonathan. It really varies on whether you make it yourself. One coffee shop that you'd know on the high street, one flat white from that has 84 mgs. So you might have a couple of them if you're lucky. Yeah. Another coffee shop on the high street, one of their flat whites has 277 mgs. So, you know, you're already over your limit if you've had your cup from them. So I think
I just don't want to start counting on top of calories and salts and sugars and fats. Now I've got to count the milligrams of caffeine in the coffee shop.
You're lucky you don't have to. But I do think it's really nice if we know that, because like I was so anxious, really anxious, like, can I have a full cup of this? Can I have half a cup? I had a bit of chocolate because there's caffeine in that. And women are already kind of anxious a lot of the time over pregnancies. You know, there's lots going on and there's lots of uncertainties and it can be a trouble, worrying time at times, you know, and we don't need uncertainty around this too. So I would love to see clarification where you could say, look, these are the calories in your flat white and these are the mix of caffeine. It would be so easy to do. And I think it would be a really good step for kind of keeping women informed and letting them make their decisions themselves.
Totally. I mean, look, if the science is saying this isn't safe, then obviously I think people need to be informed. But it sounds like the message is louder than the science on this particular one. Our final story is an answer to the question that has probably preoccupied teenagers since there were teenagers. Lara, how big is my willy?
Yes, so this actually is an answer to that question. And it's a new research paper that came out. So it looked at 17 previous papers with over 15,000 men. I was going to say people, but again, it, like with the caffeine in pregnancy, this is fairly specific to men. And the paper looked at what is the average size of a penis. And the reason that the gentleman who was the lead author in the paper, David Veal, is a psychiatrist from South London, he wants to look at this because actually this is a huge problem for a lot of people. Research has shown that, you know, around about 45% of men worry about or are dissatisfied with the size of their penis. And this research should actually hopefully be quite, I suppose, should make a lot of men feel better, because I personally wouldn't have thought that this would be the average size. But
I love the build up.
I know. I'm trying to get everyone to imagine, I suppose, when you were in school and you had a half ruler. That's around about 6 inches. Well, not around about, it's exactly 6 inches. If you have an iPhone 7, that's about 5.5 inches. So I'm just trying to get people to have an idea of what length things are in their head. So according to the team, and they're 15,500 men, the average, and this is a direct quote, flaccid pendulous penis is around 9 centimeters, which is about 3.5 inches for those who are so inclined to use inches. And the average erect penis is about 13 centimeters, which is just over 5 inches.
I thought you were going to say 13 feet would be something. I thought you were going to say 13 inches.
No, 13 centimeters. And that is just over 5 inches. So that is shorter than the length of an iPhone 7. And this is if you measure all the way from the pubic bone. And I mean, like really press in. So if somebody is slightly overweight, they press in that extra fat and they find where the actual pubic bone is. And they measure all the way out to the end of the penis. They take away the foreskin because that's kind of variable in people. But it shows that if you have an erect penis that is about 6 inches or higher, you're actually in the 95th percentile, which means that 95% of men will have a smaller penis than you. So I suppose it's just to reassure people that, like I said, in the flaccid state, around 3.5 inches is completely normal. And erect around 5 inches is normal. So I suppose if anyone's worrying about this, quite genuinely, I mean, we can say this with jest, but it is something that really, really does bother a lot of men. So, you know, you're almost certainly completely normal, folks.
I know you didn't mean it this way, but even if you have a 4-inch penis, it's also normal.
Oh my God, of
all
course.
Lengths
I'm so sorry.
Are normal. No, but you mean you're average. You're average. So
average. You're this all
is
normal.
This is the part of the news round where I rounded up with a clever quip. I'm just not going to comment on the last section in any way. I'm going to move myself safely out of this by saying Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Susan Kelleher, thanks very much for joining us. Now, in our search for life elsewhere in the universe, Mars and Venus promise so much, but so far really have delivered so very little. And at one point, we probably thought with that, our chance of finding life in our solar system was gone. But over the last 2 decades, we've made the surprising discovery that there are better candidates for habitats that can support extraterrestrial life in the outer solar system. So what are they, and when are we going? Well, Kevin Peter Hand is an astrobiologist, planetary scientist with NASA's Europa mission, and author of Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thank you, Jonathan. Pleasure to be here.
So, if you don't mind, let's orientate ourselves. Where is Europa and what is it made of and why is it of interest?
That's a lot to unpack. And so the best way to think about it is that if we've learned anything from our study of life on Earth, it's that where you find the liquid water, you generally find life, from, you know, high, low, north, south, east, west, hot, cold, all over planet Earth. Where you find liquid water, you generally find life. And so then the question becomes, where in the solar system might there have been or be liquid water? And it turns out that many of the ice-covered moons of the outer solar system have liquid water oceans beneath their icy shells. So they are incredibly compelling targets when it comes to our search for life beyond Earth. And Europa, a moon of Jupiter, is just one of these many alien oceans that we want to get out and explore in our search for signs of life.
Tell us about Europa. What is it made of? And is it covered in ice, or are there areas that are richer in ice, like Mars?
Yeah, so its entire surface is covered by ice, and Europa is about the size of our moon. And the gravity of Europa is about the same as the gravity on our moon, about 1/7 that of the Earth. And so the entire surface is covered by this ice shell. And that ice shell is maybe 10 or so kilometers in thickness, maybe thinner in some places. And beneath that icy shell is this liquid water ocean, this salty liquid water ocean that is perhaps 100 kilometers in depth. And beneath that is a rocky seafloor. And beneath all those rocks is an iron and iron sulfur core. And so that's sort of the cross section of Europa as we currently understand it.
How do we know so much about Europa, having never landed there? Can you tell us about previous missions that have been there?
So there were two previous spacecraft that gave us a lot of great information about Europa, the Voyager spacecraft and then the Galileo spacecraft. The Galileo spacecraft was launched in 1989 and finished its mission orbiting Jupiter and studying the moons of Jupiter in the early 2000s. And the Galileo spacecraft sent back images, magnetometer data, all sorts of wonderful information about Europa that helped us figure out that there is, in fact, this ocean beneath its fractured icy shell.
But to study that distant moon from here, we have a lot of groundwork to do on Earth, right?
That's right. The study of life on Earth helps guide us in understanding what kind of environments are habitable, what kinds of temperatures, pressures, salinities, pH, all those various parameters that make ecosystems possible here on Earth help guide us in understanding whether or not an ocean like Europa's could be habitable. We can study the salinity, the pH, et cetera, with remote sensing instruments, but ultimately we really want to get down to the surface of Europa and scoop up a sample of that ice and search directly for signs of life.
Tell us about the two Europa missions you're working on with NASA.
So right now, there is a mission that is confirmed to move forward, and that's called the Europa Clipper mission. And it's going to launch hopefully within the next 5 or so years, and it's currently under construction. It would orbit Jupiter and then make 45 or more flybys of Europa, studying Europa from a distance, sending back incredible imagery. It's got an ice-penetrating radar on it to get down beneath the surface electromagnetically, spectrometers to study the composition of Europa. But it doesn't have a lander. It doesn't have a component that would actually go down and touch Europa. And so that's the second mission, which is still under development, under what we call formulation. It's not confirmed, but we're working hard to try and make that mission a reality. And with any luck, we might, if there's excitement and dedication, we might get to the surface of Europa before the year 2040. I know that sounds like a long way out, but this business is not for the faint of heart.
Well, yeah, it's very much a long-term design, and there are many reasons for that, which we might get into. But in terms of the design of those missions, for us at home who aren't necessarily astronomers interested in, you know, vents and rocks and mineral composition and gas, I mean, most, I would imagine, many people at home what they're most obsessed with is the idea of life. And it seems that that is not the priority a lot of the time for scientists who are designing missions to explore our solar system. How do you feel about that? Because again, these flybys aren't going, they're going to tell us a lot about the geology, the gas composition, maybe, you know, how the moon was formed and its relationship to Jupiter, but it won't tell us that question, which I suppose has occupied the human race since the beginning of time. Is there life outside Earth?
Yeah, it is one of humanity's oldest, most primordial and yet unanswered of questions. Is there life beyond Earth? Are we alone? And part of what is so exciting about the time in which we live is that really for the first time in the history of humanity, we can launch these spacecraft to go out and directly search for signs of life within our solar system on these potentially habitable worlds like Europa and Enceladus and Titan. And so, as you mentioned, even though this question is one that excites the public so much, it really hasn't had that many dedicated missions. And so our hope is that with the public support and the excitement about what we call astrobiology and the search for life beyond Earth, we can move forward in the not too distant future with a mission that would land on Europa or fly through the plumes of Saturn's moon Enceladus and really help pursue this question of whether or not there's life in these alien oceans.
We're speaking to Kevin Peter Hand. He's an astrobiologist and planetary scientist with NASA. He's a book out called Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. Kevin, what makes Enceladus and Europa much better candidates for life than Mars, which we can get to a bit easier, and also we know has water?
Right. So let me be clear. Mars is a fantastic place to search for signs of ancient life. We think that 3 billion, 3.5 billion years ago, Mars had ancient oceans and water was on the surface. But our search for life on Mars now is a search for past life. It's a search for fossilized life. And one problem with the search for fossilized life is that the large molecules like DNA in the case of life on Earth, they don't last long in fossils. They don't last long in the rock record. And so even if we were to find evidence of past life on Mars, I don't think we'd really be able to tease out that much information about what makes it tick. And in that context, I really want to find extant life, life that is alive today, a life that we can examine and understand and look at its biochemistry to see whether or not it works on DNA and RNA or if there's some other game in town. And so these worlds like Europa and Enceladus, they have liquid water oceans today. And we think that the conditions within those oceans are sufficient for life to exist. Whether or not it originated is a different story. But this prospect of finding life that is alive today helps us potentially understand biology as a fundamental phenomenon in our universe. And so it's really that prospect of finding extant or living life that compels us.
These moons are very far away from the sun. And I'm just wondering how life would survive, what sort of energy source there is on these moons that would keep both living things alive and also keep liquid water liquid, right?
Yeah, it's a bit of a puzzle because traditionally, in the sort of original thinking about what it takes for a world to be habitable, astronomers and planetary scientists looked at the Earth and looked at Venus and Mars and saw this kind of Goldilocks scenario where in order to have life, you needed to have liquid water. And in order to have liquid water, you needed to be at just the right distance from the sun or from your parent star so as to maintain and sustain a liquid water ocean on the surface. If you're too close, like Venus, you get too hot and you boil off any water that you once had. If you're too far away, like Mars, eventually you get too cold and a lot of the water freezes, or escapes out into space. Now, that story is a lot more complicated, but suffice to say that's sort of the Goldilocks scenario. Well, what these moons of the outer solar system are teaching us is that there's a new Goldilocks in town. It's a Goldilocks where the energy for maintaining and sustaining liquid water oceans comes not from your parent star, but rather from the tidal energy that gets dissipated in these moons as they orbit worlds like Jupiter and Saturn, these very massive planets. And so in the case of Europa, which orbits Jupiter, Jupiter is 318 times as massive as the Earth. And as Europa orbits Jupiter, it gets tugged and pulled like a ball of taffy. And that stretching creates a lot of internal heat. And that internal heat then helps maintain this liquid water ocean beneath the icy shell. So that's how the liquid water oceans exist, by merit of the tidal energy. But then when it comes to how life actually exists, here again, we can look at planet Earth. And if we've learned anything from life on Earth, it's that there are these three keystones. You need liquid water. You need the elements to build life, things like carbon, nitrogen, etc. And then you need some form of energy to power life. And for the most part, when we look at life on Earth and think about the energy to power life, we think of photosynthesis. But on an ice-covered ocean world like Europa, sunlight's probably not going to penetrate to the ocean below, and thus photosynthesis is not really going to be a viable energetic pathway. And instead, we think that a mechanism called chemosynthesis might help power life at the base of these oceans. And that brings us back to the depths of our own ocean, where we've discovered over the past, I guess it's nearly 50 years, hydrothermal vents deep within our ocean. And these are hot springs that are emanating all sorts of compounds that microbes and other organisms love to eat. Hmm. And down in these ecosystems, chemosynthesis is powering life. And we think similar types of chemical systems could exist within the seafloors of Europa and Enceladus.
Yeah, we've learned so much from the exploration of the deep sea that has turned some of our understandings about life on its head, right? You were talking about thermal vents, but also other ways that creatures that never see the sun manage to live and thrive in the darkest depths of the ocean. You have experience of this, of course. I have to ask you about your time traveling with James Cameron to the bottom of the ocean. This is presumably around the time he was filming Titanic.
That's right. It was after Titanic, and Cameron has long loved the ocean. And through his filming of Titanic, he got to know this Russian team very well and know the Russian submersible systems. And those were used in the filming of Titanic. And then after Titanic, Jim wanted to get back out to the ocean and examine these hydrothermal vents. So
why?
Scientific curiosity. He loves to explore and he loves the extremes of life on Earth and right. Has a passion for the search for life beyond Earth. And so that is where I came onto the scene. I'll spare you the long version of the story, but the short version is I got a call from a friend of mine who basically said that Jim Cameron was looking for somebody to talk about Europa while sitting at the bottom of the ocean. And so that led to an IMAX movie that was back in the early 2000s. And so as part of that filming, I got to go to the bottom of the ocean 9 times and several dives in the Pacific Ocean, several dives in the Atlantic Ocean. And it was just phenomenal seeing these hydrothermal vents, seeing these bizarre creatures, these dynamic ecosystems cut off from the sun right up close, and just absolutely changed my understanding of how life on Earth works.
It's rare enough, I'd imagine, for a scientist to get that amount of dives and have that amount of freedom to explore the ocean. But you also have a rather unique claim to fame, and that is that James Cameron saved your life.
Yeah, I guess you could put it that way. It was that was quite a dive. Many of the dives are dangerous, but on one of my first dives, we were down at the bottom exploring the seafloor of the Atlantic Ocean, and for some reason the batteries started to die within the submersible. We lost communication to the ship on the surface, and then of all things, the carbon dioxide alarm went off, letting us know that we were essentially having a toxic atmosphere within the tiny sub.
So with the batteries gone and running out of air, is there any quick release to get up to the top of the ocean? I mean, I don't know how these things work. I mean, was there a pulley you could pull and it would flip you up to the top of the ocean?
So long before I actually got in a sub to go to the bottom, I worked with the Russian engineers, just kind of doing the proverbial kicking of the tires of the submersibles. And these are machines that house three people, a pilot and two scientists. And then around that is all the accoutrements of making it swim through the ocean. But really, you're sitting in a nickel steel sphere that's about a bit more than a meter and a half in diameter. And my Russian's not too good, and the English of the Russian engineers wasn't that good. So a lot of hand gestures were involved in trying to figure out how these subs work, or at least educating me in how they work. And it turns out that if worse came to worse, if we were stuck at the bottom of the ocean, you'd lift up this seat, and in that seat was a big old wrench, and you'd use that wrench to undo this bolt that would then drop some ballast that would then make the submersible buoyant, and you would then rise like a cork up through the ocean. And it wouldn't be pretty, but you'd pop out of the ocean and maybe rise several meters and then come back down splashing on the surface. And so, you know, not exactly the way you want to return to the surface of the earth, but
and quite dangerous because you don't know what's above you.
Exactly.
That sounds like that would have been terrifying. So that's not what happened, because James Cameron came to, well, the team that James Cameron was with, I should rather say, he didn't swim down there. I came to rescue.
Right. So he was in another submersible, and they kind of, after we got separated from their submersible, they eventually tic-tacked back and forth, retracing their path, and they found us, and they had a camera in there because, of course, Cameron was filming stuff. And I held up a little sign in our one of our portals that said must surface. And he was able to see it and acoustically radio up to the ship on the surface that we were coming up. And that was particularly important because it was nighttime. And even though we could have yanked on that big old bolt and surfaced and likely survived, we would have been on the surface at night, and it just would have been a bad situation.
Yeah.
So thankfully, with the help of Jim and the team and the other sub, we were able to surface without much drama.
I mean, we're joking about it, but of course, it is this exploration of the oceans of Earth that is key to being able to study the oceans of Jupiter, right? Do you think we're ready for a mission on Europa, knowing what we know about the Earth's oceans, or do we need to do more science here with better equipment to understand Earth's oceans before we can make a worthwhile trip to Europa to make a good stab at looking for life and really doing the best science that we can on a once-off mission?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jonathan, and the answer is yes to all of the above. In other words, when it comes to exploring Europa's surface and even getting into its subsurface, we have the tools and technology to get that exploration done now. There's no technological miracles that need to be invoked to do that. And really, it's just a matter of commitment to getting that exploration done. Now, coupled with that, one of the beautiful aspects about exploring these alien oceans beyond Earth is that there's this win-win of simultaneously advancing our capability for exploring and understanding our own ocean and cryosphere. And what I mean by that is just think about what happened with Mars exploration. We now have these rovers on Mars, and long before those rovers on Mars were put on the launch pad, earlier versions of those rovers were tested out in the deserts of planet Earth, because those deserts are somewhat akin to the surface of Mars. Hmm. Well, when it comes to Europa's ocean, a lot of the early prototypes of machines that we hope to someday send into the ocean of Europa, those robotic systems are currently being tested out and will continue to be tested out within Earth's ocean. And that's really helping transform how we study our ocean. Traditionally, the way you do oceanography and study the deep ocean is with massive ships and large tools, and you kind of go out and you collect a sample and you bring it back to the laboratory. Well, the way NASA works is that we build robots and they do the science on the surface of these worlds, and then they send back just the ones and zeros of the data from those instruments.
Yeah.
And so part of what we're trying to do at JPL and in partnership with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is to develop the sort of next generation of robotic vehicles that can explore our ocean for very long durations and do the experiments, do the science, make the measurements in situ. In other words, down at the bottom of the ocean. And that's really kind of changing the game for understanding our home planet, which is great.
You know how I'm going to end this, right? You said that maybe 2040s, we might get a mission to Jupiter's moon, Europa, to see if there's life. What's your gut on that?
Well, as Carl Sagan once said, I don't think with my gut. Based on everything that I've learned about life on Earth, I feel relatively confident in making the prediction that Europa is habitable. And if the origin of life itself is easy, and that's a big if, then Europa will be inhabited. It will have life within its ocean. And think about it. Either outcome is equally profound. If we do go to worlds like Europa and explore them quite thoroughly and find that there is life there, then that means we live in a biological universe, and we transform the universe to one in which biology is a universal phenomenon, not one in which it's a biological singularity just here on Earth. The other end of the spectrum, if we don't find any signs of life on Europa or Mars or Enceladus or Titan or, and all these other worlds, then that means that the origin of life is quite difficult and quite rare. And that then turns the mirror back on our home planet, where we get a better sense for how precious our own biosphere is, how precious life on Earth is. And that is also quite profound.
Well, Kevin's book is called Alien Oceans, The Search for Life in the Depths of Space. Kevin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
He's brilliant, isn't he? I said to him afterwards, he has the voice of Roman Mars. He could do anything in radio, couldn't he, Aidan? His voice is just like, it's just gold.
Yeah, it's what we call chocolate voice. The first time I listened through
I've never heard that in my life.
It's certainly what I call it. But I listened through the whole first thing and I was like, that was great. I can't remember any of it. Yeah. I was just drifting away in his voice.
He's so dreamy. Well, producer Aidan McKelvey, as you can hear, joins us to go through some of the texts and tweets from last week's episode. And last week we were talking in the news about research that shows that honey is more effective to combat colds than antibiotics. And this should be a surprise to nobody, because antibiotics treat bacteria and viruses are what colds are. Well, we got a huge reaction to it and sort of woke up dentist Twitter, which is not something I expected. So we were talking about this. Shane McKee says, I've been saying this for years, that honey is more effective. Love science that confirms my biases. It more than makes up for all the other stuff I ditch because it doesn't. Thanks for that, Shane. Evelyn says, can you please warn people of the possible ill effects of giving honey long term to children and adults at night? Honey can be just as bad as refined sugar for causing dental decay. And then she tweeted and tagged a bunch of other people who also got in on the talk. Alison Dougal says, do no harm, maybe better than something that doesn't work at all, but the risks outweigh the benefits. Common risk approach, please. Kristen Fitzgerald said, occasional use of honey to remedy a sore throat won't cause long-term harm, but regular and frequent use can become a habit. This is so terribly damaging to teeth. Keep honey to mealtimes. No sugar last thing before bed, honey included. And lots of people got very animated about it. I don't think we were saying to take it every time. We're going to take it when you have a cold. If you remember, at the time, Dr. Laura Dungan, Aidan, sort of said, this isn't a great study, to be honest, in the first place, because you're comparing a measure that is mildly okay to something that doesn't work at all. So, of course, you're going to see an improvement.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm being naive, but I think people know that, you know, you shouldn't eat honey all of the time.
Yeah.
It's bad for your teeth. Like, I kind of thought that went without saying. We weren't saying that, like,
you see,
you know,
but you
form
don't
your
know.
Whole diet around honey.
We don't like I you one of the biggest mistakes I made, I think mostly to my 20s and 30s, was assuming that people knew what I knew, and actually it's just not the case. And so you have to fine tune this performance on air, don't you, to kind of bring people in who may not know, and sometimes you're kind of guessing, well, maybe people don't know that, so I should mention that, but I know it, so maybe everybody knows it. It's kind of tricky, to be honest.
Am I harsh to say that, like, Twitter kind of makes people go, oh, hang on, this is in my wheelhouse. I need to be outraged about this.
Well, I don't think,
I have knowledge about this that I need to tell everybody.
They were all being reasonable, but yes, there is a, you know, and also nature to that thread for sure. We were talking about negotiation with David Sally. Franklin Awesome Doberman on Twitter says, negotiation is a fun skill which has hugely been lost by the reduction of discussion and debate on social media and in our general society. Do we do a lot of negotiating on Twitter? What has social media got to do with Twitter? I'm not sure I fully get that. We were talking about global warming. Brian says, with all that meltwater from the ice, I wonder what the effect will be on the density and salinity of the sea, and thus what effects those changes might have, for example, on sea life. Have you never, I mean, how could you have missed so many graphics, infographics, alarmist books, TV inserts. Brian, what happens is we're all going to be swimming and pretty much everything's going to die. That seems to be the overall message here. I mean, am I oversimplifying it there, Aidan? Maybe I am.
Yeah, probably oversimplifying.
We'll get some tweets about that, I'm sure. So our tweet of the day comes from... Franklin Awesome Doberman again. He says, Jonathan, maybe this virus pandemic has been engineered to purposely reduce human effects on the planet because those in the know realize climate change is going to change our environment and existence. Look, I think if anyone was able to do that, actually, do you know what? That's actually probably a good question, Aidan. We should probably do a piece on whether or not it would be easy to engineer something this catastrophic to the human race.
I think we had a piece before, not a piece, but a piece in Newsround where Lara said, she didn't say it would be hard to do it, but it would be virtually impossible to do it and for it not to be obvious that it was engineered.
Would it be easy to genetically engineer a killer virus and put it out and have it have the effect? I don't think it could. I mean, that must be hard. Although there's a program that I go on and on about because I absolutely loved it. It's a series called Utopia. And it was a Channel 4 series, and it's sort of got a doomsday vibe to it. I won't ruin it for you, but it kind of goes into this question a bit. I don't know. I don't think it's... look, I know this obviously is a bit of a joke tweet, but I don't think it'd be that easy. I think we've wanted to tweet top that. Column C says, I think most people these days accept that anthropogenic global warming is an agenda run by the UN and does not have any basis in real science. Aidan, this is a guy who... likes to tweet these conspiracy theories quite regularly at you, is that right?
He does, yes. He's always very polite, I have to say. We end up in debates, but he's not like he actually said to me before, he accepted the fact that most scientists, you know, believe in anthropogenic global warming, as he's called it. So I don't know where he's coming up with this. I think most people these days, because I think he'll find that most people these days do not accept that that's an agenda run by the UN.
No, I think so. In fact, that's the first time I've heard that conspiracy theory. But there you go. I don't think global warming is an agenda run by the UN. We were talking about face mites a couple of weeks ago, and Kevin Conroy says, catching up on last week's show on face mites, oh dear, I feel sick. From an evolutionary point of view, what's the point of Demodex? Does there need to be a point? I don't know. Well, it certainly worked out fine for the Demodex, and it doesn't really bother us. So, it works out just fine, doesn't it? And finally, we got an email from Noel. He says, hi, I listen to a lot of podcasts, everything from TED Talks to This American Life to BBC. I have to say, Future Proof is the gold standard for me. Woohoo! Your range of topics and ability to treat listeners as fellow listeners is just A1. You mean in other shows, the presenter actually knows something, whereas this, he doesn't. The podcasts are the icing on the cake. I really admire your production decision to tackle negative feedback. Invariably, your treatment is sensible and sensitive. It's a joy of a program. And then he goes on to embarrass his daughter by being dad proud about her. So I won't. He says, don't mention that. She'd kill me. Anyway, thank you so much for the best radio show I can find, nationally or internationally, Aidan. Well, let's just end on a high note and say happy weekend. And thanks very much for that, Noel. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producing Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt, who are researching Steve McLoone, who are on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.